Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 24th. It's the 26th. The 26th of March. Oh, I know how I get mixed up. It's because our guest the first hour wrote a piece in the March 24th issue of Salon.com. So that's why I'm thinking I'm involved in the article and the discussion. So, but today is the 26th. The March 24th Salon.com has a great article, Uprising on Main Street. Today's populist rage could regenerate America if Obama handles it right. It looks at a history of populism in this country and how it lives in our fears and expectations too deeply to be trivialized or replaced, not always offering practical solutions, but it unerringly expresses deep national feelings. A lot of people are fairly outraged. That may be an understatement about what's going on here. Our guest says the long overdue outburst of populist rage could mark a decisive shift in America's attitudes toward income inequality. It could also prove temporary, just another populist crest in a long cycle. That's the topic for this hour. It's going to be a good one. I'm sure of that. Our guest is Gary Camilla, a journalist, executive editor, and one of the founders of Salon.com. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation today. And Gary, thank you very much for being with us. What an article. It was a good one.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Tell me how large, you quote this in the article, and I kept saying it out loud to people in my family. Can you believe this? How large is income inequality right now?
Well, it's staggeringly large, and it's been getting worse for decades. But we now have a situation in which 1% of the country makes 22% of the wealth, which is, you know, just staggering. I mean, it's sort of Honduras-like levels, and it's been just progressively getting more and more extreme for decades.
And when you look at what the salary is of, what are these figures, that it's 19,000 times the salary of the average worker, the salaries of, who are these people?
No, I think that's the hedge fund managers.
Oh, hedge fund managers.
I can't recall whether it's the hedge fund managers or some other derivatives executives, but these are the absolute top of the plutocrat chain, and their incomes, they're 19,000 times that of the average American.
Wow. So tell me about the racket that we're making. You talk about it being so loud that Washington can't tune it out. How are we expressing the rage?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously constituents are really letting their representatives hear about it. As I say in the piece, when you've got a senator going on the floor and suggesting that executives that have misbehaved may want to emulate the Japanese and commit suicide, this is not a normal course of politics. And the politicians aren't just making this up. They're hearing it from people. And, of course, the question remains, is this ephemeral? Was it just an outburst about the AIG bonuses, which were, you know, widely and correctly seen as outrageous? Is it going to fade when that particular item fades off the front page? I don't think so, and I certainly hope not.
And why don't you think it will fade? Is there going to be something else?
Yeah, well, I think that the current financial meltdown, even if people are not, you know, and I myself, you know, I think like most Americans find, you know, credit default swaps and these exotic derivatives and financial instruments, you know, incomprehensible. But I think that people, whether they understand all of that or not, are aware that the system has been gamed, that the insiders who have gained complete access not only to the levers of economic power, but have gained enormous control in the government, have been able to work loopholes, and as Obama said in his 60 Minutes appearance, you know, most of what they did was legal. It is not like most of what happened here was illegal. This was working within our system, and the system has generated not only this, you know, enormous wealth inequality, but it caused our entire financial system to go into the worst wreck since the Great Depression. So people are obviously feeling it profoundly. Right. There's an incredible amount of pain and suffering in the country. And pain and suffering is kind of what is the generator of populist outrage. It doesn't necessarily always have a coherent result, and sometimes it can have, you know, it can go cut both left and right, and remains to be seen how it's going to cut. But the main point is that people, when people hurt, they no longer are inclined to view the system with the same equanimity or approval that they did before. Now, I don't think that means that, you know, the United States is going to become Sweden overnight or ever, probably. I don't think that we're going to become a socialist country. But I think that we are going to have an enormous amount of pressure for much more control of uncontrolled capitalism, for much more regulation, for much more transparency, and perhaps, and this is probably the most hot-button one, perhaps for much higher marginal tax rates, which is, you know, what we had in World War II. And we may start going back in that direction. As people say, I don't care how good they are at running these hedge funds. 19,000 times more money than me is not justifiable, and it's not good for society. And, you know, people like Warren Buffett have said that themselves. So, you know, I think those are the the factors that are really driving the political discussion now.
It's immoral, and as you suggest in your column, it's not Christian, right?
Right. I mean, the idea that there is, you know, you can simply, you know, have that degree of inequality. I think that living in a capitalist society, which is the greatest generator of wealth, you know, in human history, no one is arguing that we're aiming at complete equality. Although, you know, you could certainly argue that that's a Christian precept. But to reduce the extreme levels of inequality does seem moral and yes, indeed, Christian.
Mm-hmm. This is a really important paragraph. Well, I love the whole piece, but this paragraph, let's talk about for a moment. The populist eruption, you write, represents Obama with a tricky challenge in the short term and a unique opportunity in the long term. In the short term, and I ask you, how does he do this? He has to negotiate between populist rage at Wall Street and the fact that unless he fixes Wall Street, Main Street will go down with it. That puts him at least temporarily in a no-win situation.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's facing a really hard choice that way, because people don't want to give any money to the you know, incompetence and the you know, the bandits that looted society. They don't want to give any money to them at all. At the same time, you know, this is an enormous ship that Obama's trying to turn around. He can't simply you know, opt out of the current system. Now, you know, people on the left are very divided about whether or not the plan to create a public-private fund to get rid of the toxic assets is the right way to go. I mean, I don't have the economic expertise to pronounce with any confidence on that. People like Paul Krugman don't like it. Other progressive economists are taking a more, you know, wait-and-see attitude towards it. And again, it's the same issue. The question is this once again staying within the current parameters of the game and letting the people that screwed it up try to fix it and rewarding them too much? You know, I'm concerned about that, but I think the larger issue is if he can make this work, and, you know, there are people, there are arguments on both sides, if he can make it work, then I think it's pretty clear that his long-term plans are indeed progressive and aimed at reducing income inequality and in shifting not only the way that the financial system is set up, but our whole national priorities in this regard. And I think his budget reflects that. And then you have the entire other debate, which is, you know, crescendoing now about the enormous deficits that his budget is creating. So yeah, he is really facing an enormous series of problems on many fronts, and it's going to be an incredible challenge for him to work through them.
He really needs the puppy. I mean, puppy. He really does.
Right.
It is time. There's been some criticism. I'm wondering what your take is on this, Gary. You talked about people who have gamed the system. What about the people like Geithner, like Summers, perhaps others, who are now trying to fix the system and coming up with these plans? Can they be the people to do this when some have criticized, I wonder if you think rightfully so, that they've already gamed the system?
Well, you know, obviously this gets back to the point I was just making about the new plan and whether or not this is basically rewarding, it's giving too much of a stake to the big equity funds, to the private sector that was so responsible for this. And the counter argument would be that the government should simply nationalize, you know, for these let the bad ones go bankrupt, figure out ways of cushioning the blow, and, you know, let them die and go on with actual government ownership of these. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is possible. It is certainly theoretically possible that insiders, despite being insiders, can take control of the levers of the economy and move them in a different direction. Just because they were insiders does not mean that they can't use their expertise in different ways. I'm not such a sort of mechanistic thinker about this, but I think that if you were an insider, you're going to be devoted to nothing except the aggrandizement of firms and insiders that you knew, which is the most cynical view. And, you know, there's some evidence in some cases where this has happened. So I think that they can, you know, play a different role, but I think it's a real concern. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of people were and are very concerned that Obama's, you know, financial team was drawn from a very traditional stock of Wall Street, and that, you know, they were, in fact, you know, some of the same folks that got us into this mess.
Right. Give us, before we go to phone calls, and our lines are jammed, as you can imagine, a brief history of how populism has lived in our politics, in our fears, as you talk about, and expectations. We've been through something like this before. We've had populist outrage. Has it resulted in some significant changes?
Oh, without question. I mean, the original populism in the late 19th century was largely a rural and mining phenomenon. And it was a response to the enormous excesses that were generated in the so-called Gilded Age, which followed Reconstruction, which was really the first time in American history that Americans had to confront income inequality on a vast scale. And it was actually, you know, they became a very powerful third political party. They never won, and they didn't last very long, but they did succeed in some significant changes. You know, there used to be 12-hour work weeks and child labor, and you know, a lot of laws were passed as a result of the original populist movement that moved in that direction. Then the progressive movement, in some ways, was driven by these same forces of Teddy Roosevelt in the early 20th century. Obviously, in the Great Depression, there was an enormous upsurge of anger. And, you know, both the Socialist and the Communist parties became quite powerful. And FDR was pushed hard from the left in order to affect a lot of the policy changes, which really were the greatest shift in terms of controlling American capitalism. All of the great iconic institutions of the New Deal, Social Security, and all the rest of the things, much more regulation of the stock market. And then, you know, but there's always been a double-edged sword to populism. Populism has veered in sometimes ugly directions. There were undercurrents of anti-Semitism, more than undercurrents, in Father Coughlin's populist crusade. And, you know, in the so-called culture wars, we see also a populist phenomenon cutting to the right, which was, you know, very, very cleverly used by Karl Rove and by Republican political operatives to take take American anger that's sort of free-floating at elites. And those elites could be seen as economic elites, but they could also be seen as cultural elites. And by shifting that in the direction of the cultural elites, so-called, that's been a very, very effective political tactic for the Republicans for many years. And we might be seeing now the breakdown of that particular attempt. You don't hear so much about the culture wars when people cannot pay their PG&E, you know, their electrical bills, and so it's moving back in the direction of economic populism, which of course also can cut both ways, because again, you know, you can simply, there is a school of libertarian thought that simply says let them all fail and keep government out of it, and some of it cuts that way as well. So it's not clear where it's going to end up, but it's another major outburst that we've seen periodically in American history.
Let's go to phone calls. We'll do that in just a moment. Gary Camilla is our guest, executive editor, one of the founders of Salon.com, and he has a great piece. I urge you to go to it. March 24th issue, just a couple days ago, of Salon.com. Uprising on Main Street, today's populist rage could regenerate America. if Obama handles it right. 800-486-8655 is our number. And I think you can send an email today as well. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about this really interesting book on Teddy Kennedy, Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. Our guest will be the Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, where he oversees all national coverage for the paper. And, of course, this paper has been covering Teddy Kennedy for a long, long time. So it's a great book. That'll be our second hour conversation. Let's go to phone calls now, and we'll start with Pat from Eau Claire. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good.
Good.
You know, this is really kind of it's a bizarre situation we've gotten in. You know, we live in America where it's a capitalistic society where we've been told from day one that if you work hard, you become educated, you know, and you're going to be successful and you're going to reap the rewards. You know, and I don't think anybody's really opposed to people making money. I mean, anybody that can cut open my chest, take my heart out, fix my valve, put it back in and keep me living.
Right.
That guy deserves a lot of money.
Right.
Absolutely.
But then I think people are looking at this deal up in AIG and go, what do these people do? They're an insurance company. They don't contribute really anything. And that's the thing that really kind of bugs the American people, that why are these people getting so much money? What are they really contributing?
What do they do, Gary?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the financial markets are a big part of wealth generation in our society, and they, you know, they keep the stock markets high. And when the stock markets were high, you know, all huge numbers of Americans benefited from that. So when the system was working right, it obviously produced vast amounts of wealth. That, you know, that all Americans, you know, when they saw their pension funds or their you know, stock market holdings go up, they were very happy about it. So that I think that it isn't that this is all complete hocus pocus. It's in fact, that's the problem. I mean, it's so deeply tied into the fabric of the American economy that when Wall Street gets a cold now, the rest of the country gets pneumonia. So the problem is, I think that it isn't simply that, and I think, you know, the caller makes, I think that some aspects of this, without doubt, and the most particularly toxic aspects of the financial meltdown, the trading and credit derivatives and these kind of like swap derivatives, these things are completely, they were all multiply leveraged, sliced up insurance bets that really were unproductive and were just instruments to generate short-term money that actually had catastrophic long-term consequences. So I think there are aspects of the way that people were, you know, gaming the system that were completely unproductive and that were destructive. I think there's other aspects of the financial markets that are economically productive and that, you know, we're not going to be able to get rid of our financial system. But I think what we need is we need to separate the wheat from the chaff, and we need transparency, and we need accountability, and we need regulation. And you know, actually today, President Obama announced that they're going to be pursuing much, much more of that, more than was expected. So I think that's a very good sign.
Gary, how does the government decide, and have they done this in the past, what as we take over, you know, AIG in large measure and other financial
right.
institutions, how do we decide what these people are worth? Because aren't we in the business and won't we be more and more of determining what executive compensation should be for these jobs and we don't know exactly what they do?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the government has to get under the hood. And the first step, which is the root of the whole problem now, is to actually find out what these assets are worth. And, you know, this is the biggest problem, is that to some degree, we're letting the market, we're going out there now and trying to let the market set what these assets are worth, and it's not clear yet. We don't know. I mean, the more skeptical folks say, you know, like Paul Krugman, that once you really look at these toxic assets, they're going to be worth much less, and that's why this whole plan is going to fail, which would be, you know, catastrophic, or at least very, very dangerous, because it would force Obama to return again for more and for another enormous amount of money to bail out these companies again. And so, but then the question of compensation, yes, absolutely. I mean, you have to determine what a that's the $64 question in terms of the sort of politics and the new direction that that America might go in about compensation is the degree to which people will begin to pressure the administration to say we are not willing to sign off on unlimited compensation in perpetuity for all for things we can't even understand.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to be a big fight because that runs against a deep tradition in America that you don't ever regulate any kind of compensation. But I think, you know, if there was ever a moment for that to be looked at, this is the moment.
This is it. Thanks, Pat, so much for your call. Bruce from West Milwaukee. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for the call. Your author is right on target with this, and there clearly is reason for outrage. I think the issue with Obama is going to be quite complex, as he's saying, because he won't word the whatever word the use the word socialism or nationalism, and it seems pretty clear that these banks need to be taken over, and not by the Heritage Foundation, but by someone that has an idea on how to address the valuation of these toxic assets that need to be taken off the books somehow. But yeah, does the money go to the people to pay their credit card bills, or does it go to Citicard to compensate them and then let the people still have to pay off their bills? You know, the American middle class has been disenfranchised for the last 25 years since the start of the Reagan administration, and no one has. And the middle class finally woke up and realized that the whole system was weighted against them, and the middle class is outraged at being excluded from the wealth mechanism now, and furious that only 1% are reaping it, and at a cost to them. And it's like, I'm waiting for the guns in the streets. I mean, when is this going to happen?
Right.
When are people going to be going after the banks? And, you know, I mean, it's like, this is a third world country, you know. It's about time we behave like one.
it's a lot of people are surprised. You're absolutely right that they're actually, despite, you know, the fact that there's a lot of anger and a lot of letters to congressmen, that the anger has not progressed beyond that. And, you know, without calling for violent revolution, it might be salutary if the protests were louder than they are, because it would certainly get a message even more clearly across to Washington, exactly what you're saying, that, you know, this is becoming a society of the super haves and then the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really the America that most of us thought we were signing on for.
And then they've had the gall to take away our money that we use to retire, our money that we use to take to send our children to college. It's just unconscionable in many ways.
Well, that's the true tragedy. I mean, there are so many tragedies. We all, I'm sure, have had no friends, family, or ourselves who have had these incredible hits. But yeah, I think that the idea of an older person who's worked really hard their whole life and is ready to retire, and all of a sudden they look at their retirement accounts and they go, oh, my God, I have to work for 10 more years. I mean, this is just cataclysmic, and it's unconscionable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, this is the kind of tragedy that is fueling this outrage. This is unacceptable.
Thank you, Bruce, so much for your call. John from Madison is next. Hi, John.
Hello. Well, it's only 2 months into Obama's term, but still, I would say, make an analogy of Abraham Lincoln in trying to prosecute the Civil War with McClellan as the head of the army.
Mm.
McClellan didn't want to engage the enemy, and when he did successfully engage the enemy, he wouldn't pursue the enemy and destroy him.
Right.
Until he got Grant and Sherman in there, he was going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he has put Geithner and Summers as his chief experts now. And he said he's supporting Geithner, and Summers. And, I think his loyalty to Geithner and Summers doesn't supersede his loyalty to the American people. Geithner and Summers to me are analogous with putting foxes, trying to get the foxes out of the hen house. And I blame Geithner and Summers for the compensation of the AIG package, even though it's less than 1/1,000th of the $170 billion going in there. I absolutely think they're part and parcel of the problem. The American banking system is highly insolvent. The only reason they're getting around this is they're valuing their assets in non-market terms, and everybody realizes they simply can't get away with this. And this private public bailout is socializing the costs and privatizing the gains. And the public's never going to get the money for paying out prices on these toxic assets that are never going to be realized.
Yeah, no. I mean, that is the big concern. I'm choosing perhaps in a Pollyanna-ish fashion to remain agnostic on this, but I share your concerns, and I think many people do, and I think there's enormous sense of apprehension that, yeah, as you say, that we're only socializing, we're socializing the losses and privatizing the gains in the way that this has been the toxic asset approach has been set up. And I'm very concerned about it, but I'm choosing to hope that that this will at least stop the immediate financial bleeding, and that the long-term economic priorities that Obama has will have a chance to begin to take hold.
Thanks very much for the call, John. We go next to Rich from Rhinelander. Hello, Rich.
Hi. I'm going to begin with a joke to show
good.
How out of whack things are.
Yeah.
Rush Limbaugh's base salary is $100 million a year. Now, I know in my heart that Joy Cardine, Kathleen Dunn, Gene Faraca, Ben Marin's all earned twice that. You're paid easily $200 million a year
for what
you do.
Right.
And Bruce and John were cutting through the fog. I got a history lesson from John. But here's a ridiculous idea, but it's no more ridiculous than what we're being dragged through right now. The people's mantra should be, why didn't you just give us the money, stipulating that we should pay off our mortgages, we should pay off our credit bills? Supposedly, that would have made these lending institutions, these financial institutions, solvent and liquid and able to lend.
Mm.
The plan now is to take my tax dollars, give them, and your tax dollars, give them to financial institutions so they can then lend me money and other Americans money and charge us interest for the tax dollars that we just gave them. Now, it's a ridiculous idea to say you should cut a check to every American household, but it is no more ridiculous than the ridiculous Obama plan of rescuing me and you through rescuing the financial institutions of this country who have gotten us in to this crisis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rich. They'll have your call. Gary.
Yeah, well, I mean, I understand the emotional appeal and the immediate pocketbook appeal of that. I mean, obviously, the problem is that we cannot, the way our system is set up, we don't have time, I think, to give all the money to individual citizens and then hope that props up these institutions. If these institutions go down, we then are in the Great Depression. I mean, we're in a different situation then than we are now. Then we're in bread lines, and we do have armed people in the streets, probably. It's a whole... And I'm not trying to justify or stand up for these institutions. I'm just saying this is the reality that we're faced with. I'm not... Obama, in a way, is choosing a sort of an odd centrist path in addressing this, where in a way it's kind of soft nationalization without the name, and it's somewhat half baked in the sense that he's achieving a lot of the same things that you would achieve by explicit nationalization. There's so much regulation and so much control that why not just go whole hog and do that? He's playing the game within the rules of the system while trying to change the system at the other end. Mm. It's a tricky, complicated balancing act that kind of reflects, I think, that Obama is not as much of a left-wing politician as, many of us probably thought he was. There's always been a strong school of thought that Obama is progressive, but that he's centrist. And, I think the way he's handled the economic crisis so far pretty much shows that that is, in fact, right, that he's not a sort of a raving socialist, as, you know, as the Fox News Brigade calls him, that he's actually, you know, playing it in within the system, and he may be playing it within the system too much, but we'll have to see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to happen? And it's hard to imagine that things are going to turn around so rapidly that it wouldn't happen when the next request for more bailout money comes. How could he possibly get such
a
thing
passed? If this one fails, you mean?
Right.
He has to go back and say,
right,
we weren't able to actually, you know, unload all these toxic assets.
Uh-huh.
We need more money. Well, you know, I think he would get it, actually. I mean,
really?
I think that he would pay a severe price, and that there he would lose, you know, the vaunted political capital that he has. I think it would be severely depleted, and there would be a lot of anger. I think, though, that if the president of the United States comes before Congress and the American people and says, I've got to do this. If we don't do this, we're all going down. And if most economists, as they would, I think, would agree with him, then I don't see that people would say, no, don't do this. I think there'd be incredible anger and resentment about it. And in a certain way, it actually might. There's actually been arguments that it would be better for a progressive agenda if that happened, because it would actually then force him really to the left on this issue, and it would force him to actually explicitly nationalize and to take much more direct steps than he's doing now. So, you know, you can see it that way as well. But it would be the biggest problem would be not just the political one. The biggest problem would be if that happens, and if it hasn't worked, we then would be teetering on the edge of the abyss.
Mm.
And nobody except somebody that is so deeply into partisan politics that they've lost their mind would want that to happen, because if we fall into the abyss, then we're really ruined.
Right. Isn't it amazing and so tragic, Gary, that all these policies were allowed to exist and nobody was regulating all of these people who are making so much money for such a long period of time? It's just terrible.
Yeah, well, I mean, it began philosophically with the Reagan Revolution. And, you know, Reagan was a president who constantly told us that government was the problem. Now, Reagan was not actually particularly radical by modern standards as far as his actual economic policies went. He had the huge tax cuts in his first term. But then when he realized that he was, you know, facing an enormous economic meltdown and huge deficits, he turned around and he raised taxes to an unprecedented degree, which is something that, you know, his defenders on the right like to forget. So Reagan sort of talked a better game than he played in terms of this extreme deregulation. But what he did was he set a kind of an ideological tone that government is bad, that government should have nothing to do with anything, that the free market should just be allowed to run everything. And in George W. Bush, you actually in many ways saw somebody who did what Reagan, you know, did in his first term and then undid in his second. He sort of talked the talk and he walked the walk. And and Democrats should not be let off the hook on this either. I mean, the overturning of the Glass-Steagall Act, which is one of the real key moments in this whole mess, which basically, you know, allowed, deregulated these kind of institutions that have wreaked this havoc, that happened under Clinton's watch. So the Democrats have been part of this whole culture of deregulation as well. And, you know, to be fair, even Robert Reich, the liberal economist, you know, says deregulation can be good for business. It's not that deregulation is always bad. It's just that you cannot take it as far as we've taken it. You can't simply remove all oversight, all transparency, because you will end up with self-dealing. You'll end up with people gaming the system, and you'll end up with, you know, the vast income inequalities
right,
that we've seen.
Well, I also, these people are making all this obscene amount of money. You wonder how they can just go to sleep at night and live with themselves. I mean, who the heck are these people? Maybe they need morality courses.
Well, you know, it's one of those funny things. I think that, you know, I'm sure a lot of these folks actually are decent human beings. I mean, some of our listeners may not want to hear that, but I think that it's kind of like the crab that gets boiled in the water. You start out, you're doing these transactions, and you're creating a lot of paper wealth for your company, and you know, that actually gets that raises stock prices for other people. So in terms of, it's not you actually are creating wealth, not just for yourself, and you're obscenely compensated. But, you know, hey, we live in a country where baseball players and movie stars and, you know, there are so many people in our society that make obscene amounts of money. There is some, you know, anger at that, but it's pretty much an accepted part of the American system. So it isn't as if, you know, everyone that makes a lot of money in this country feels bad or even should feel bad necessarily. It's sort of like, where do you draw the line? These folks keep making more and more money, and what they do has less and less relevance to any tangible, actual commodity that helps anyone, except for making paper. It turns out it was all paper money, and it was all an enormous bubble. The entire thing was a complete fraud. So, but no one realizes that at the time. No one ever realizes they're in a bubble, and I can speak to that in personal experience, having been in the dot-com space. You know, we had a pretty good bubble there, and you know, those of us that were in it didn't fully grasp what was going on. It's human nature not to know that you're in a bubble, and I think the good news about this bubble bursting is that this one is so big that people now, I hope, are going to say, you know what, we've got to change the system so that these bubbles cannot ever get this big again. There are always going to be bubbles. As long as we have a capitalist system, there's going to be bubbles. It's the nature of capitalism. But you can't have bubbles this big, and that means that you can't have that much wealth, inequality. The two are sort of part and parcel of the same thing. And I think that that's, you know, really, if something good comes out of it, it would be that. I think that we could have a fundamental shift a la the Great Depression. We're not in a Great Depression, but we could, you know, have a significant movement where people say, you know what, yeah, you should feel ashamed if you make 190,000 times or 19,000 times more, that this isn't right. It's fine to be rich. We're not saying there should not be rich people in this country, but we are saying that to have that degree of wealth inequality on something that where you're simply gaming the system, no, that's actually is shameful. It's not American, and we're not going to stand for it anymore. And there may be that may happen.
Ray from Milwaukee's next. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I'd like to just mention my blood has gone from boiling; it's converted into steam. That's how angry I'm about this subject. But Warren Buffett had two quotes. One was from 5 years ago, somewhere around there, and the other one was from 2 years ago. And the older one was his quote about our tax system and capital gains. Now, this is Warren Buffett speaking, one of the richest men in the world, as far as I know.
Right.
He said his secretary is taxed at a higher bracket than he is himself. His secretary is, because he is taxed as capital gains, and his secretary is being taxed through payroll income tax. Now, in this country, if we're going to reward people that just shift around stocks and bonds for a living, and we're actually giving them a 15% tax rate, and then you're going to tell a guy digging a ditch or the secretary, you got to pay over 30% of your wages. Now, that is just, that's asking for trouble. And Warren Buffett himself said this, and this was 5-6 years ago. But his second quote that I'd really like to hear your thoughts on are what he labeled credit default swaps. This is his quote. They were weapons of financial destruction. And if Warren Buffett was saying this 2 years ago, and now all of a sudden everybody is shocked, this is a house of cards falling apart. Me and a lot of my buddies at work have been talking about this for 4 or 5 years, that this was just a big house of cards. And we... why we're allowing any one company to be so large in this country that it actually threatens us, why don't we send the military in? Because this sounds like a national defense problem.
Right? Yeah. That might be necessary. No, and absolutely. I mean, the major regulations that Obama announced today are aimed exactly at companies like the ones that you discussed, the ones that they call too big to fail. Well, you know, we should not allow these companies to get to this point. The problem with uncontrolled capitalism is that it tends to become monopolistic. That's why we have the Sherman Antitrust Act. That's why we have transparency regulations, which have largely not been enforced. And absolutely, and the credit default swaps and all these arcane financial transactions. People were blowing the whistle on these things, not just Warren Buffett, but many people were blowing the whistle on this stuff years ago. But as long as the bubble just kept expanding, and as long as people's housing values, which were also part of the same bubble, kept going up, no one noticed. And this is a real wake-up call for America to not allow this kind of irrational exuberance to be so systemic that there's no countering of power to it. And hopefully this crisis will prevent this from ever happening again.
Thanks, Ray, for your call. More phone calls in a moment. Our number 800-486-8655. And our guest is Gary Camilla. He's a journalist, executive editor, and one of the founders of Salon.com. Has written a great article in the March 24 Salon.com, Uprising on Main Street, Today's Populist Rage Could Regenerate America If Obama Handles It Right. He says when big business becomes essentially a branch of government, a development that's been happening for decades, there is no impediment to the self-dealing behavior that has now resulted in the worst economic meltdown since the Great Depression. All right, more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, in May of 2008, Senator John McCain said this: "I've described Ted Kennedy as the last lion of the Senate. He remains the single most effective member of the Senate if you want to get results." The editor of the book Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy by the team at the Boston Globe, Peter Canellis will be joining us. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. So that's coming up the second hour of our program today. All right. Gary Camilla is here now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Before we go back to phone calls, Gary, do you have any sense if things are going to go right or wrong here? These issues are so huge, the possibility of failure seems to be fairly great. I mean, are you really worried?
You know, to tell you the truth, I just don't have a clue. I think I tend by nature to be an optimist, but I actually feel like many ordinary Americans, and the economy is certainly not my area of expertise, that I feel like I'm out of my depth here in terms of trying to assess whether, the problem is so multifaceted, it's so complex, that it, and if you read the experts, and I try to keep up, a layman with the debates between the experts, they don't agree. You can find economists on both sides of this. So my sense is that I don't think we're going to have a Great Depression. I don't think that the system is going to fail. But I think that it could be long and bloody and difficult, and we may not see the end of the sort of acute phase of this recession for another year. That seems to be the conventional wisdom on this, and that's pretty tough. That's bad enough considering how much pain and suffering has already been inflicted on people.
And then to make it even larger, it's not just us. So you have to take in, when you do your research on this, the whole darn world. We've got tens of millions of people losing their jobs and economies collapsing.
And it's much worse in many other countries than it is here. I mean, we're cushioned to some degree by the fact that, we have a robust economy, we're broad-based, and, there are, Iceland, basically, the entire country went insolvent. There are, in Eastern Europe, there are countries that are desperately running to their neighbors in the EU and, asking them essentially be bailed out, and they, because they don't have an fully integrated political system, they're facing tremendous problems. So, it's a global phenomenon, and it's, the Chinese, what are they going to do about the dollar? I mean, there's just so many worrying aspects about this in the long term.
Right. Joel is next from Heartland. Hi, Joel.
Yes, hi. I was wondering about where's the outrage for the bonuses paid to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as well. That came out about a day or two after the AIG bonuses. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Joel.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not really familiar with the specific bonuses the caller is talking about, but no, of course, I think that in every case in which you have really high levels of compensation for companies that essentially, you know, went down into the tank and helped take a lot of the country with it, I think that, you know, outrage is justified. And obviously there's a political dimension to this question because, you know, conservatives have tended to seize upon those companies as driving the fall, which I think is, you know, they played a role. I think most economists don't see them as the primary drivers, but absolutely. I mean, there's no reason that anyone on either partisan side of this argument should let anyone who is involved in basically running a large institution into the ground off the hook. It's the same principle. If it's what's good for the goose is good for the gander, I think, in terms of these levels of executive compensation.
Dan from Wausau, hi.
Hello. I think a large part of the problem is one that is virtually never discussed or addressed, and that's that our federal government has abdicated the authority granted to it by the Constitution to issue money to a private for-profit corporation that most people don't realize is that, called the Federal Reserve, which creates money out of nothing and loans it to us at interest. The issue is really well explained, and it goes way beyond what I can discuss in a little video that's available on the Internet called Money as Debt. And the entire foundation of the monetary system and fractional reserve banking is largely the source of the boom-bust cycle that we're so painfully experiencing now.
You want to comment on that, Gary?
It's beyond my pay grade. You know, I mean, I think that the Federal Reserve is the way that we've run our system, and it has tended to work. I don't know that that's the problem, but I'm not an economist, so I'm gonna pass on that.
Isn't it amazing what you've had to do as a journalist the last couple months in terms of learning about this hugely complex issue?
Oh, it's definitely headache time for somebody like me who, you know, has always regarded the economy and the economy or economics as the dismal science, as it's known. But we don't have the luxury of not at least attempting to get our heads around some of this stuff. And I don't pretend to any expertise, but I think that all of us have had to try to learn as much as we can because it's affecting all of us right in our pocketbooks and in our politics.
Right. Greg from Watertown, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. I think at the root of the problem is a matter of ethics. We've abandoned all type of ethical behavior in our capitalistic system, and we call it capitalism, but we've escaped the discipline of a true capitalistic system, and we operate as a socialist type of economic system on part of the aspects of the economic system, and it's capitalism in some aspects, and it gets turned every which way. And it seems to me that is not an honest interpretation of what capitalism is all about. It's not fair to the people that are involved in it, the people that invest their money. It's not a responsible action that we are taking to safeguard people's investments in our ecological commonwealth. Mm-hmm. It's not respectful of future generations that are going to be inheriting this terrible mess that we're creating. And where's the compassion in it? You know, where's the compassion for the people that don't have a boat or their boats are leaky? If we were to return to ethical behavior, and I heard on public radio just the other day that ethics is a obedience to the unenforceable, and it's difficult to put any type of law that is going to regulate ethics, something that we have to do from our heart and from our own consciousness. Mm-hmm. And until we reach that, we're going to be in this mess.
Mm-hmm. I think he makes a good point. I think we need to return to some ethics as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really excellent point, and I think that what I hope is that President Obama, who I think really does excels at appealing to these instincts, you know, if we can get over the short term of this crisis, he clearly wants to instill the kind of ethical sense that we're all in this together, that is more Christian, that's more ethical, that is more deeply connected, and that is something that hopefully can become a bipartisan sense, that, you know, we are in this together and that we're responsible for each other, and that the just purely predatory capitalism is not the direction that we want to be going in, that we need to restore some ethics into our system. And I think that's a really, really good point.
Keep putting those tent cities at the front of the newscast and the front page of the newspapers.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you were a great guest. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Great. Well, good. That means you'll come back. He was good, wasn't he? Gary Kamiya, and you are as well. You're a great audience. How can people say no to you? Gary Kamiya is executive editor and one of the founders of Salon.com. Again, I tell you that his piece, which is titled Uprising on Main Street, Today's Populist Rage Could Regenerate America If Obama Handles It Right, is the March 24 Salon.com is where you can find his article. It's well worth a read. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader, our wonderful volunteer, for answering phones. And thank you, everybody, for all of your wonderful phone calls. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour of conversation for this Thursday morning. Great book on Teddy Kennedy, looking at his early life and looking at the illness that he's dealing with right now and the tragedy and redemption of Teddy Kennedy. So that's coming up in just a moment here on the Ideas Network.